News Talk Sunday.
Fast-moving story over the last 24 hours, really, which is the operation known as Epic Fury. That's what the Trump administration have put onto this operation, a joint Israeli-US attack on various Iranian sites, military facilities, and of course some other parts of their physical infrastructure. But the big news, I suppose, is the death of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei over the last 24 hours, now confirmed by the Iranian independent plus independent sources over there. So this is a massive milestone event in the history of Iran. So I'm now joined to discuss that aspect of it by Tara Kangerlou, who is she's a global affairs journalist and author of The Heartbeat of Iran and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. She joins me now. Tara, just kind of bring me up to what you think the sentiment is going to be. Obviously, the Iranian population, it's very divided, very polarized. Some people are pro-regime, an awful lot of people are anti-regime. So what do you think the reaction will be, if you can kind of generalize for us, hearing this news over the last few hours?
Good morning. Indeed, Iran is a country of 90 million and certainly not a monolithic society. But I will say with confidence, speaking to friends, family, and also sources across the country, that many are celebrating today. I mean, Ali Khamenei, for over 30 years, held an iron fist, a grip over Iran, and was responsible for the repression, oppression, and isolation that we've seen. So certainly he has his supporters and followers, people who are ideologically charged, people who are part of the IRGC apparatus, who really benefit from the regime financially and structurally. But I will say with confidence that the majority of the public are quite jubilant. They see an end to a figure who they call a dictator. But I think what awaits is critical. No one really knows. We heard line from President Trump in the United States, who is doubling down on his strikes, as supported by Israel, and also the regime in Iran. Forces are vehemently attacking the Gulf region, which, by the way, I think is perhaps strategy for Iran to have them push the U.S. to back off. And maybe they're trying to and do that.
In terms of the reaction within the country, as you say, 90 million strong, is there a group in the middle who don't like this regime and actually are firm opponents of it, but would also be firm opponents of the way the Trump administration and Israel in particular is carrying out and executing these attacks upon Iran? So is that group could be swayed in either direction, or is that a fair analysis?
That's an excellent point. I think the nuance here is that the Iranian people are so resentful toward the regime. In the words of a woman I spoke with who was present in the protests in January, she said there is a sea of blood between the Iranian public and the regime. But at the same time, the Iranian people are quite smart and sophisticated. They've seen what happened in the region, in Lebanon, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and they don't trust outside forces. So none of them believe that Trump and Israel are doing this because they actually genuinely care about the well-being of the Iranian people, right?
Yeah.
So they're very well aware of that. Some more, some less. But again, the society in Iran has been choked to such extent and such extremes that any opening for any form of possibility of change is welcomed by the Iranian people.
I'd say a lot of them as well are getting sort of an unsettling feeling at the idea that descendants of the Shah may be coming back. I know there's many options that may occur, but that was also a brutal regime, as we saw, and really brutally cracked down on people in the late 1970s. So people would have a lot of memories of that, certainly among the older
Indeed.
Demographic. So is there people saying, we certainly don't want to, having swapped out the Shah in the circumstances,
exactly,
have his family come back, be kind of almost, you know, it's just really bad Punch and Judy kind of show, covered in blood on both sides?
Indeed. And I think what we've seen in the region, as much as we don't want to say it or admit it, the people don't have the power to decide. And that's quite unfortunate, right? And if Mr. Pahlavi comes from Washington, it is very much something that has been supported and backed by Trump and Israel. And, you know, it is public knowledge that Mr. Pahlavi is supported by Israel. And that can be an option. The answer to that is, I don't know. But as far as people's support goes, some, you know, vehemently opposed him, but some passionately support him. And then there's a whole lot of people, millions in between, who just don't know and in some ways look at him as a transitional figure. But then again, you have to understand the agenda and the objectives of any form of leader who comes to power, whether it be someone from inside Iran or Mr. Pahlavi from outside or someone that we don't even know about. But again, Iranians are smart. They remember history, but at the same time, they are so desperate for a moment of change and just a moment to breathe, have a normal life. And that's really the sentiment on the ground.
And the other point, I suppose, is that can the current administration, it's a very theocratic regime, this is a big question, but can they reconstitute themselves at all under this bombardment from Israel and the US? Or is the game up, in your opinion?
I mean, we know that Israel and the United States combined have the greatest military on the planet, right? So if the United States continues with its military strikes, they can very well contain much of Iran's military arsenal. But the question is whether or not they want to do that. As far as the regime scrambling to pick a supreme leader, that's what's happening right now. There is a transitional group of three: the head of the judiciary, the president, and someone from the Guardian Council. They have teamed up to lead this transition. And then the next supreme leader would be picked by the assembly of experts. Again, as you mentioned, it's a theocracy, a clerical regime. But then within the system, the IRGC apparatus, there are figures like Larijani, Ghalibov, whose names are popping up. Now, how they take over and take power, again, we have to wait and see. So right now, anything, quite frankly, is possible. And I can say with confidence that the regime is really going all in, because at the end of the day, what do they want the most? To survive. And that's what they're doing.
Yeah, and I mean, we've seen them go into sort of liberal phases before under Rafsanjani and so on years ago, but then they seem to revert back to the brutalism. So it's kind of hard to get where they kind of move. They bob and weave between two models. So they have had liberal moments, but then they seem to end after a few years.
I mean, I actually grew up in Iran when Rafsanjani was president. And at that time, he was seen as a conservative figure. You know, life wasn't that great under his reign. But then years later, he sort of evolved into a reformist character. But at its core, if you speak with ordinary Iranians, this is a system that has not proven to reform, if you know what I mean. And even characters like former President Khatami and Rouhani, we haven't heard from them really. Many believe that they have been, I don't want to use the word detained or house arrest, but they've been really sidelined by these sort of more radical conservative IRGC forces who are trying to do all they can to stay in power. Again, we have to remember that they control much of Iran's oil, gas, infrastructure, and the economy of the country is in their hands, and they want to hold on to that power. But the story is evolving and moving so fast. And by the way, any one of these key figures can at any moment be hit, because, you know, we've seen high-ranking members of the IRGC and the government being hit in the last 24 hours. And who knows?
Yeah. In a strange way, nothing may happen. They may just simply hunker down for the next few days and see what happens then. Listen, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for your input. She is the author of The Heartbeat of Iran. Her name is Tara Kangaloo. Really do appreciate you giving us that direct perspective on where the future of Iran might be. It's very murky, but it can go either way. It's certainly a fork of the road moment in a very, very significant way. Let me bring in some of our other contributors. Paul Brandis is from West Wing Reports. Paul, we've been seeing this described everywhere, really, as the biggest gamble of the second administration of Donald Trump. So if it is that gamble, how's it going?
Well, I think it is. I think that's a fair assessment. And it's too early to say where this is going. I mean, much depends on a lot of what your prior guest talked about, which is who emerges from the rubble. I mean, literally, who emerges from the rubble here. It could be the son of the late Khamenei, who of course was killed. It could be the son of the Shah, who has lived here in the United States for a long time. It could be somebody else. It could be perhaps one of the, there's a woman who has been a leader of the young people in Iran, who most of whom are under 30. Her name is Maryam Rahavi. She's very interesting. She has what she calls a 10-point plan that advocates free elections, separation of religion and state, gender equality, a non-nuclear Iran. She says that our path forward depends upon not returning to the buried dictatorship of the past. That's the kind of language that I think the young people of Iran, who again are the majority of that 90 million country, want. Of course, whether she succeeds depends to be seen. And upon that is President Trump's legacy. We're only in day two here, and there's a long way to go. So it's too early to say what will happen. But I agree, this is obviously, I think, the biggest gamble of the Trump presidency.
But it's kind of part of a pattern. I mean, a lot of us are trying to reconcile Trump in his first term with Trump in his second term. I mean, he used to say, you know, Hillary Clinton is a hawk. He used to say she'll bring us into wars. He had the same thing to say about Kamala Harris in the last election in 24. And we're all sort of looking at this Donald Trump, this iteration, and maybe it's because he's surrounded by Pete Hegseth and other bellicose figures. But what has happened to Donald Trump of the first term versus the second term? I mean, I know that's a difficult question for you to answer, but there's just the contrast is so stark between those two public individuals.
It's so interesting. I read yesterday an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that was written in 2023, just 3 years ago. And the writer of the article said, "I support Donald Trump because he will not get us into any wars overseas. No more of this nation building. No more sending American troops into harm's way. That is why I support Donald Trump." The writer of that article was a guy by the name of J.D. Vance, who is now Trump's vice president. So, you know, it's so interesting that these folks have really turned 180 degrees from just a couple of years ago. I mean, Trump has now attacked, I think, 8 or 9 countries. And the question around that is, and this concerns, you can apply this to Venezuela and all these other places that he has attacked. Is there ever an example where the United States goes into one of these smaller countries, blows things up, the leader is gone, and then, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road, a better leader emerges? Is there an example of, you know, some democratic country that's favorably disposed to the United States emerging? So that's an interesting question. So I'm not sure that's going to happen in Iran.
So what do you put it down to, this transformation, this image makeover that Trump has undergone?
Well, one thing about it is that I think he has been pressured for a long time by Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, who has obviously wanted to get rid of the Iranian regime his entire life. He has pressured Trump for a long time. And we've also learned in the past day that Trump, in the past couple of months, has really had his arm twisted, excuse me, by MBS, the leader of Saudi Arabia, the crown prince there, who has really, Saudis are no friends over the Iranians. And the Saudis have pressed President Trump also to attack Iran, get rid of their enemy in the region. So between the Saudis and the Israelis, Trump, who of course does not read a lot, talks to a lot of people but doesn't read, he's very easy to persuade. So I think that perhaps could be a reason why as well. So,
but he seems to get irritated by people in the MAGA base who say he's spending too much time on foreign affairs. He's spending too much time out of the country. Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, she's stepping aside, but she's had a few pops at him saying, why doesn't he just concentrate on the U.S. domestic economy? He's all on these foreign adventures. And that sort of, that drumbeat seems to be establishing itself a little bit in the MAGA base. So, I mean, surely that worries him, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe he's not standing for re-election again, so he doesn't care. But it does seem definitely a very pronounced trend and debating point among MAGA.
Well, nothing succeeds like success. And if it turns out that Iran turns into some pro-Western country, which I'm frankly a little skeptical of, that perhaps may shut some of his critics up. But again, it's only day two here. But you're right when you say this MAGA base, they are livid about this. Another foreign war. How is he different from George W. Bush? Iran is three times bigger than Iraq. We know how that went. And now here's Trump going into a country three times as big. You know, so he's really opened a Pandora's box here. So I'm not surprised that a lot of his base is really angry about this. What about all of the problems we have here at home? And here he is running around the world, bombing people just like George W. Bush and all the others.
Okay, Paul, thank you for that. I also have Simon Calder joining me, of course, travel journalist. Simon, a lot of disruption in the international travel trade, particularly in the Middle East. We've heard airspace closed down a number of places, flights out of Heathrow shut. So can you bring us to a sort of an overall picture that something looks a bit murky for the rest of us?
It certainly does. And look, I've been covering this. It's now about 24 hours since we saw the first shutdown of airspace. Clearly, there were concerns about what was happening in the Gulf. But actually, once the Iranians started sending in missiles and drones to attack key targets, which they seem to include hotels and airports in that, clearly the airspace was going to close. And just to give you some idea, if you take the three airports of Dubai International, busiest global hub in the world, Etihad in Abu Dhabi, and, of course, Qatar Airways home at Doha, they have about 2,500 flights every day. That corresponds to 500,000 people who simply aren't going anywhere. And a very good example is at Dublin Airport, the 1,000 or so people who would normally be going out on the Emirates to Dubai, Qatar Airways to Doha, Etihad to Abu Dhabi. They were cancelled last night, and guess what? They're all cancelled coming in this morning. Same thing for tomorrow, except that a little chink of light. At the moment, the Etihad flight, they all come in between 6:30 to Dublin Airport in the morning. The Etihad flight has not yet been cancelled, so maybe things will improve. But at the moment, every hour that this goes on, you're kind of adding tens of thousands of people to the problem.
And Simon, do you get? Am I right to say pretty much the airspace is cut off virtually to every country in that region? Like, there's no exceptions to that.
Well, look, if you're a commercial pilot, and any country, any flight information region, to use the air traffic control term, says do not fly in this area, you don't fly in that area, particularly if it's missiles flying around. So it's entirely done for safety. But of course, there will be Irish travellers who are in those places on holiday in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and in Qatar, and they will be very, very keen to get away. But at the moment, it's difficult to see what the exit strategy is. I suspect that when things reopen, you will see an awful lot of kind of one-way only flights, and it may even be that the UK and possibly even the Irish government arranges special flights to come and get the people who are, well, I've just spoken to a couple who have spent the night in an underground car park sleeping on concrete because they obviously wanted to be sheltered if Iran is going to send in more stuff.
I wanted to ask you that about hotels. A lot of people are in Dubai. They would have booked the original hotel. Maybe they're there for 3 or 4 days. Maybe that's starting to run out. Have you heard anything about what hotels in the region are doing? Are they allowing guests to stay on? Are they giving them a free, you know, free day's accommodation in the circumstances? Are they being moved? Have you heard anything about the hotels?
Right. And now, look, I need to say that I'm in Istanbul at the moment, so I'm not as close to what's happening as I might be. But certainly the airlines are trying to provide hotels where possible. The According to a report, which I have not yet verified, but it's in the Khalij Times, which is the kind of newspaper of the UAE, English language, and it says that the government has said, okay, we've got all these people here, we will pay for their hotel rooms and their meals. Now, I absolutely stress I haven't heard that for definite, but it would be a very welcome gesture, because otherwise people are going to have to pay up front in many cases and then try and claim the money back for their from their travel insurance. So, the whole idea of being in what was, until this time yesterday, a lovely warm holiday destination and suddenly turned into a war zone is just awful, I'm afraid.
Now, I don't know about travel insurance and all of that that much in detail, but you've got force majeure and all of that. You've got war. So will this be covered, this type of event? Or are people unfortunately going to be a bit on their own here?
I don't think you would find insurers in Ireland or in the UK saying, oh, no. I mean, because a typical case would be somebody who is, I don't know, in Bangkok or Mumbai or Sydney, flying back to Ireland via one of those Gulf hubs. And they are incurring large amounts of costs for staying in hotels, having meals and so on. They may need to book an alternative flight back. And I think that's exactly what insurance is invented for. And I think that those would be looked upon kindly. I would hope they would anyway. The thing to do is give your airline a chance to sort things out for you. And if they can't, then take matters into your own hands and hope that you will be able to get it back from the insurer. But it's a really difficult situation for so many people.
It really is. I mean, people, as you said, would not have had any foreknowledge of this. They would have just gone on a sun holiday. Considering the winter we all had in Britain and Ireland, you can understand that urge.
News Talk Sunday.